And we are going to roll right into our politics segment today. With us, as always, is Illinois Public Media's Washington correspondent, Linda Kenyon. Linda, good to talk with you again.
Well, thank you, Brian. Always happy to be here.
Well, it's another week, another former top Trump administration official or officials going public with their concerns about his potential reelection. This week we heard from John Kelly, who was a four-star general in the Marine Corps. He went into the Trump cabinet as director of Homeland Security. Then he became Trump's chief of staff. And this week he added detail the past revelations he made about how Trump asked him, among other things, why can't you be like the German generals? And to be clear, he was talking about Hitler's generals. And I do want to, I have a little bit of tape here. I want to point out that political science has the definition for the type of government Germany had under Hitler, and that is fascism, which is something else Kelly talked about this week on tape with the New York Times. Let's listen to an excerpt the Times shared on its website.
What do you think? Do you think he's a fascist?
Well, I'm looking at the definition of fascism. It's a far-right, authoritarian, ultra-nationalist political ideology and movement characterized by a dictatorial leader, centralized autocracy, militarism, forcible suppression of opposition, belief in a natural social hierarchy. So certainly, in my experience, those are the kind of things that he thinks would work better in terms of running America.
All right, Linda Kenyon, like an unprepared Jeopardy contestant, I am struggling to put my reactions to this in the form of a question. So I'll just ask you, what do you make of this?
Well, I can tell you what Donald Trump makes of this. He has lashed out at John Kelly and said that he is, quote, a lowlife and a degenerate, and saying that this is simply the case of a disgruntled former employee. I will tell you what other former employees of Donald Trump have said, including many military leaders and members of his administration. And they are saying that this is true, that the former president did say, why can't I have more generals like Hitler had? And he also said Hitler did some good things. Those are quotes. You know, this is just part of the scenario that is coming forward late in the election, although a lot of people who are saying things, former employees, including General John Kelly, are also saying, look, Donald Trump has been telegraphing this for quite some time. And, you know, if he says he's going to do something, he's probably going to do it. I mean, we've already said that we've already had discussions about what's going to happen on January 6th and how January 6th was, as Kelly and many other administration officials have said, is not going to be an isolated incident, that Trump has said many times himself in many of his rallies that he will not contest the election if he wins. But if he doesn't win, you know, this is something that Washington is, by the way, preparing for. They're having their skullduggery sessions in various offices about what happens if January 6th repeats itself. They're dealing with a lot of security concerns surrounding Inauguration Day and the leading up to Inauguration Day on both sides of Pennsylvania Avenue. So there are a lot of concerns that there will be a repeat, and that what John Kelly is saying and what so many other folks have been saying is in fact the truth. And we are, you know, some of those statements have come from the vice president, from Elizabeth Cheney, from several other sources.
Vice President Mike Pence, who is pointedly not endorsed his former running mate. Let's listen to one more clip from John Kelly's interview with the New York Times.
I mean, is he the biggest threat to the country that you've seen in your life out of all the threats, like post 9/11, all these different things?
Well, I think he's certainly the only president that has all but rejected what America is all about and what makes America America in terms of our Constitution, in terms of us, our values, you know, the way we look at everything, to include family and government and he's certainly the only president that I know of that was certainly in my lifetime that was like that.
Linda, I'm trying to keep in mind the larger context for this. Are there other past presidential candidates for any office or any job, really, in which colleague after colleague comes forward saying, we work with this man, we know this man is a danger to the republic?
No. We have not heard anything. There is nothing in the history books about that. Generally, after someone leaves an administration, they are very loyal to that administration. This administration of Donald Trump has really broken the mold. And the president himself, the former president, has broken the mold in terms of how people view him and his administration. I mean, for example, former White House press secretary Stephanie Grisham, former White House communications director Alyssa Farah Griffin, former Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Matthews, former Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci, former National Security Aide Olivia Troy, they have all said Donald Trump demonstrates every day that he is not capable of being Commander-in-Chief of this great nation. That is a quote. That is not from me. That is a quote. The other quote, the American people deserve a leader who won't threaten to turn armed troops against them, won't put his quest for power above their needs, and doesn't idealize the likes of Adolf Hitler. That's a quote from these dozens of members of the Republican Party, of the military, of his former staff, releasing a letter saying these things. So it really does, as I say, break the mold. We've never seen anything quite so outspoken about a former president for whom these folks have served.
Well, we are certainly living in interesting times. Linda Kenyon, thank you for sharing your perspective with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you.
More to come after a short break. We're going to be talking about Illinois politics. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. After a lengthy and grueling jury selection process, we finally heard opening arguments this week in the corruption trial of former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan. Here to talk about some of the latest developments in our Friday Politics Week in Review is Dave McKinney, government and politics reporter for WBEZ in Chicago. Dave, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about what arguments did the opening statements of the prosecution and the defense tee up?
Well, the arguments that we heard from Madigan's co-defendant, Michael McLean, were really familiar because, you know, as everyone recalls probably that, you know, McLean stood trial back in the spring as part of the ComEd trial. And so the arguments that we heard on that front were very similar. But this marked the first time we've heard legal arguments out in the open from Madigan's law team. And, you know, the main takeaway from, I think, what we heard from them was that, you know, Madigan had no idea who, you know, what people were saying behind his back. I mean, that was the argument that Tom Breen, his defense lawyer, made to the jury. And Breen, of course, he's famous for getting Rolando Cruz off death row and for, way back in the 80s, Gary Dotson, getting him cleared of a rape charge. And it was kind of a dramatic moment where he's just kind of in this folksy homespun way, telling the jury not to believe the charges against him from the government, that these are all trumped up. And again, Madigan had no way of knowing what, you know, someone like Mike McLean might have been saying about him if he wasn't part of that conversation.
Because one of the allegations here, one of the key, I don't know if it's an allegation, but how would you say, one of the key prosecution theories here is that when Mike McLean, who was sort of a consigliere, a friend to former Speaker Madigan, when he would speak to people in the State House, he was speaking with the authority of having Madigan's approval.
Yeah, that's right. The feds have portrayed McLean as an agent of this kind of vast racketeering conspiracy that Madigan was the head of, you know, that it involved, you know, alleged bribes and other sorts of favors that benefited Madigan and enhanced his power, and that McLean was the surrogate that Madigan allegedly used to convey messages so he wouldn't have to do it himself and to protect himself.
All right. Well, on this point, let's listen. This week we heard from former state representative Lou Lang, who testified for the third time in front of a jury now about his call with Mike McLean, who, as you said, is on trial alongside Madigan. Lang at the time, this is from several years ago, was facing sexual harassment allegations. And in this call, McLean had a message for Lang. Let's hear what he had to say.
Well, this is no longer me talking. I'm an agent, somebody that cares deeply about you, who thinks that you really ought to move on.
So that tells me that person is no longer interested in moving me up in leadership, right?
That's right.
So, Dave, talk about how that tape played into the proceedings this week.
Well, I mean, so Lang is this recurring witness, as you point out, that the feds have used. And, you know, people... Lang had been a presence at the State House since the late 1980s, and at the peak of his power, he was the number three ranking House Democrat. He was a deputy majority leader. And in 2018, when this call was made off of a wiretap on McLean's phone, Lang had already weathered a public sexual harassment allegation against him. And what was happening now was that there were concerns in Madigan's orbit that there was another woman who was possibly waiting to emerge with details of another alleged harassment situation. And she had conveyed allegedly that if Lang was moved up in leadership, perhaps to majority leader, she would go public with this. And so Madigan and McLean were talking with one another about how to handle this because, you know, the Me Too situation was in full bloom at that point in time. And Madigan was scrambling to try to contend with it. And so, you know, Lang took the stand and you could tell that there was lingering bitterness, I think, from Lang toward these people. I mean, Lang, it acknowledged from the stand his admiration of Madigan's leadership, but then in terms of whether he felt like Madigan respected him all the time, he there was one point where he paused and he said not always. And so you could tell that there was I wouldn't say bad blood necessarily, but you know, these were allegations that in the end didn't pan out against Lang. So Lang's political career was ended, as we heard there, by Madigan and McLean for allegations that weren't, you know, in the end supported by evidence.
You know, if somebody's out there listening and wondering, like, what does this have to do with corruption? Maybe we should just draw out that the idea here is, again, that McLean was able to sort of operate when he spoke to people in the Capitol. He was speaking on behalf of Madigan. And I assume in future weeks, the federal government is going to try to lay out their case that things that would be allegedly criminal misconduct that McLean was, you know, when he was dealing with ComEd and other entities and people in the State House, that would contribute to this racketeering charge. You know, I do want to ask about McLean. I'm still fascinated by him as a character. Dave, I was talking with a group of my reporter friends. I think you probably know these people. I won't name them. But we were marveling, as we have many times in the past few years, how disciplined Madigan always seemed about his communications and how undisciplined his buddy McLean was. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, in the end, I've thought about that too, that like, if you're Madigan, don't you harbor some resentment potentially that the government was able to gather all of this evidence, a significant chunk of this evidence, by listening into these conversations involving McLean. I mean, there were other conversations.
And emails. Madigan famously doesn't have a cell phone, and McLean loves to email. Yeah,
absolutely. And it all sort of, you know, some of the language that we've heard McLean use in those emails and conversations, it takes on kind of this aura of something that you would have seen in a movie like The Godfather, where there's this coded language that McClain uses to refer to Madigan that we've all heard. You know, he calls him himself just this code language that is used to describe Madigan. So I think that, you know, McClain is an interesting character. I mean, I remember a colleague of mine, Dan Mihalopoulos, got a tip early in this it was in the investigation before McClain and Madigan had been charged, but we knew they were under investigation, that the deferred prosecution agreement with ComEd had been out. And the tip was, if you go to this restaurant on the Chicago riverfront, you'll find Mike McClain having lunch. And so he and I went to that restaurant, and sure enough, there was McClain, and out he came and into this revolving door. We kind of, I wouldn't say trapped him, but we talked to him for a few moments. And I'll never forget, I had time for like one or two questions. And, you know, he acknowledged, McClain did, about how he had been asked repeatedly by the feds to cooperate, and how he would act that, how he viewed that not only as an act of betrayal against Mike Madigan, but an act of betrayal to himself. And so he made clear at that point that he wouldn't betray Mike Madigan. And that's why you see McClain on trial now, because he refused all of these overtures from the government to basically flip on Madigan.
What are you going to be watching for as the trial continues to unfold?
Well, we're at a stage right now where a lot of what is coming out is really kind of, you know, TV reruns, if you will, because these, you know, what the feds are doing right now is telling a new jury about all of the circumstances surrounding ComEd. And as we know, ComEd, they acknowledged their role in this scheme, paid $200 million fine to avoid prosecution on bribery. But, you know, they were involved in putting, political allies, precinct captains of Madigan's, on their payroll in these no work jobs as a favor to him. At the same time, they were trying to get, really substantial legislation through the Capitol. And so we're at a stage now where these allegations we've heard and that have been adjudicated already are being presented. And I think what will be interesting as we go along the line here is when we get into the aspect of this case with Madigan, where it gets into his property tax work, where there, you know, it involved another government informant, former Alderman Danny Solis, who also secretly recorded many conversations, including with Madigan, where he takes the stand and outlines what exactly Madigan said to try to drum up business for his Madigan and Getz and Denner law firm.
Well, it's a fascinating case. I'm sure we'll have more to talk about in the weeks ahead. Dave McKinney with WBEZ, thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us. Have a great weekend.
You too, Brian. Thank you.
This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are in the middle of our Friday Politics Roundtable. It's been more than 2 years since thousands of migrants started making their way to Chicago from the southern border. Many of them arrived on buses paid for by Texas Governor Greg Abbott in protest, he says, of the Biden administration's immigration policy. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson reflected on that earlier this week.
This act was meant to destabilize Chicago as a welcoming sanctuary city. We fought back and showed the world just how welcoming we can be.
And to that point, the city built up a system of migrant shelters as the crisis reached its peak. But the flow of migrants to Chicago has slowed dramatically. And this week, Mayor Johnson announced the city's streamlining of its shelters, and arriving migrants won't be guaranteed beds anymore. Joining me to talk about this is Heather Sharone, political reporter for Chicago PBS station WTTW. Heather, welcome to The 21st Show.
I'm glad to be here.
So what exactly is changing as far as new migrants are concerned?
Well, a significant amount is changing, but I think you hit on the biggest one in your introduction. Up until now, if you were somebody who made your way to Chicago after crossing the southern border and requesting asylum and being granted what's called parole, if you got to Chicago, the city was going to find you a bed for at least 60 days, and in many cases, much longer than that. Now that the city is unifying its shelter system for anybody who's unhoused. That means people who have lived in Chicago for a long time or just arrived. That will no longer be the case. And I think there's a real question about whether after the first of the year, when this new unified shelter system is set to launch, whether we're going to see a really significant increase in the number of unhoused people on Chicago's streets, especially new arrivals, as the city likes to refer to them.
New arrivals. So, okay, as we said, this is not what it once was. There was a change in border policy on the U.S.-Mexico border that has slowed significantly the number of people, but there are still a few thousand migrants, I understand, in facilities across Chicago. What you mentioned this concern that people may end up on the street. What are some of the other humanitarian concerns that you've heard about this?
Well, there are approximately 5,000 migrants in city shelters right now, and after the new system launches, there will be a total of 6,800 shelter beds available for both migrants and Chicago's longtime unhoused population. The problem is that is about 1,200 beds short of the current need now. And I think that really raises the possibility that you're going to see an increasing number of encampments in Chicago's parks. And of course, this is all set to change just as the weather has at least the possibility of becoming brutally cold. So I think there are lots of questions about where people are going to sleep, how they're going to access food, and whether the city's nonprofit organizations, which, you know, the city is really counting to sort of step into this breach, can really handle that influx. Mayor Brent Johnson was very upfront that the city cannot afford to keep the number of beds available that it has in the past. The city is facing a pretty massive budget crunch, both in this current fiscal year of 2024 and projected for 2025. He says this is what the city is capable of doing, and that they are all working as hard as possible to avoid any case scenario.
You know, I'm so glad you mentioned the financial situation. What is it, a $200 million gap this year, $1 billion next year? I was having a conversation with a guy who runs a store in Madison County, Illinois, which is near St. Louis, who said he was so irritated that his property tax money was being sent to Chicago to help the migrants. And of course, that's not the term he used. Can you talk about where the money for this is coming from? Because that is not how property taxes work, is my understanding.
Right. Well, so it's basically coming from three buckets. Taxpayer funds from Chicago, and since this sort of humanitarian crisis began, city taxpayers have paid about $200 million during that time. The rest of the funds have come from a combination of state funds and federal assistance. And in all, you know, it's been a very expensive endeavor, as you can expect, because you're not only housing people, you're feeding them every day. And many of the people who arrived in Chicago from the southern border really had nothing but the clothes on their back. And in all, since the crisis began through earlier this month, which is what we have the latest numbers for, the sort of the new arrivals mission, as the city calls it, has cost $541 million. So that's a lot of money, but it is not the kind of but it does not come sort of out of the pockets of other people in a lot of ways. These are funds that the city has sort of set aside out of surplus funds. And Chicago, unlike other places like Denver and New York, up until this point has not had to cut services to longtime residents to care for the migrants.
I saw even a story where New York City was now paying people to take buses back to Texas, apparently, or paying for that, I should say. What a fascinating time we're living in. Heather Sharon is a politics reporter for Chicago PBS station WTTW. Heather, I've been a longtime fan of your work. I was surprised this is the first time we've actually talked on the show. Thanks so much for making time to be with us today.
Well, the feeling is mutual. Thanks for having me, Brian.
More to come after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.